surged as high as 200% after the country instituted its green pass system, which requires people to prove their vaccination status to enter public venues. France has also instituted their system and has seen a similar surge in vaccination rates.
Yeah, so it's working.
Yep.
While the new rules and vaccine requirements are great in helping to curb the rate of infection and encouraging people to get vaccinated, we must not forget about the workers who are being called on to enforce those rules. No one should get harassed simply for doing their jobs and trying to keep themselves safe.
Yeah, you're right. Just as a reminder that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors. Doc Griggs?
Thanks for listening to the Noise Filter Daily Podcast. And remember to get some rest to boost your immune system. And Doc?
Protect yourself and others by staying home, and please wear masks when you go outside. Remember, health is a human right.
Democracy is an experiment, and so is community radio. During this fall membership drive, KBOO will take a deep dive into democracy in all its forms, from current events to music programs. KBOO is your community connection. We're non-commercial and independent. We're supported by our members, so show your support by becoming a member of KBOO today. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. You can also mail a donation to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214.
KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. On our show today, we'll speak with Jonathan Marks, author of The Perils of Partnership, Industry Influence, Institutional Integrity, and Public Health. Then Dr. Gary Fuller on his latest work, The Invisible Killer, The Rising Global Threat of Air Pollution and How We Can Fight Back. And finally, John Patrick Leary joins us to discuss Keywords, the new language of capitalism. That's coming up in just a moment. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kulhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The idea of public-private partnerships to spur innovation or promote public health is not controversial. Local and state governments and even the federal government often rely on relationships with private corporations to fund initiatives, making an implicit assumption that competitive pricing and efficiency will result in better outcomes. But a new book exposes the ugly downside of public-private partnerships. In entering into agreements with private companies, government institutions are often loath to hold accountable the very entities on which they depend and end up trading away the rights of real people. When the line between the private good and the public good is blurred, the public often pays the price. My guest is Jonathan H. Marks, director of the bioethics program at Penn State University and affiliate faculty in law and international affairs. He's also an academic member of Matrix Chambers, London and Geneva, a leading group of human rights lawyers. His TED Talk, In Praise of Conflict, has over a million views and was the basis for his new book, The Perils of Partnership, Industry Influence, Institutional Integrity, and Public Health. Welcome to the program, Jonathan.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this idea that we should enter into partnerships with private companies as not necessarily being a good idea, I feel, came into view quite starkly with the recent crashes of the Boeing aircraft, the MAX 8 aircraft, where we have now found out after two planes have crashed within 6 months that the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, that government agency that is, you know, supposed to be protecting the public good, had essentially turned over regulation and oversight of its aircraft to the very manufacturers. Do you see this as an example of exactly the kind of thing you write about in your book and why these PPPs are not a very good idea?
So the examples I raise in the book are to do with the food and soda industry, and actually I also talk about the opioid industries, cases in which public health is at stake. The example you cite is one, of course, in which public safety as well as public health is at stake. And I think it's part and parcel of a larger picture, which of which public-private partnerships are a major part. But the idea is that we rely more heavily on the private sector, including collaborating with the private sector, and that we step away from regulating the private sector. And I think the 737 MAX example you gave illustrates fundamentally why we need regulation and why there should be distance between government and industry. And, you know, I argue in the book, it's not as though government is inherently good and industry is inherently evil. Nothing of the sort. Each is capable of good or ill, as current politics often remind us. But there's important reasons for distance. The government can't do its job of regulating industry if it also happens to be partnering or in bed with industry.
Right.
And I think
so
you're right.
Let's talk about that aspect of it, that there is supposed to be a tension between the government, which represents the public, and industry, which represents private interests and profits, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, we have created corporations in order to generate a profit. They depend for their existence on generating a profit by selling goods or services. But the job of government agencies is to protect the public good and public health. And, you know, my view is if a corporation and the executives of a corporation are not complaining about the regulators, you have to worry about whether the regulators are doing their job. As you say, that is the whole point. They should be in a relationship of tension and at times direct conflict.
We seem to live at a time where that line is incredibly blurred. And I'm wondering why you think that has happened. Why do we have government officials touting the benefits of partnerships with private corporations and you know, giving us the sense that it's superior? For example, I mean, the healthcare debate in the United States today is rife with this kind of thinking that private health insurance companies, we are told, are the most efficient way to deliver healthcare, and that our government-run system would simply be too bureaucratic and too inefficient. We should be relying on these private corporations. How has that come about to be this way?
Well, the first thing just to say, of course, is that that claim, as you and I both know, is totally untrue. If you look at publicly administered healthcare systems, their administrative costs are in the single figures, often low single figures, whereas the administrative costs of systems like the one we have in the U.S., and actually there is none quite like the one we have in the U.S., you know, estimates of the administrative costs of that system range from 16 to 30-something percent. So huge percentages of our health insurance and healthcare costs are administrative. So that's the first thing. And second, that you ask, how come the popularity more broadly of the partnership model? Well, I think often public health agencies are strapped for cash. They need money. And corporations are more than willing to provide that money because it gives them opportunities to burnish their reputation. And to purchase influence. You know, the corporations totally understandably develop strategies of influence involving government agencies, regulators, public health agencies, the academy, public health NGOs, and all the rest of it. And we should totally recognize that they will try to do so to the full extent that the law permits. But these other entities have an obligation to insulate themselves from industry. And that includes government agencies, public health agencies, who often run into the arms of industry to take the money, when instead they should be standing back and asking themselves some very difficult questions first.
Let's focus on some of the examples that you have in your book. You mentioned the opioid crisis. How does that incredibly broad public health crisis that has taken so many lives, how is that an example of how public-private partnerships have failed the public?
Absolutely. That's a great question. Well, the opioid industry, like the pharmaceutical industry more broadly, has engaged in all kinds of partnerships. Senator McCaskill and her team produced a Senate committee report a year or two ago in which they described how not just Purdue Pharma, the makers of OxyContin, but a whole host of opioid manufacturers had given a huge amount of money to a number of health professional organizations, pain management associations, and the like. And when I say a huge amount of money, I don't mean from Purdue's point of view, which has billions of dollars of revenues and profits.
Purdue Pharmaceuticals,
from
yeah.
Yes, but it was a drop in the ocean from their point of view. But it was a lot of money, you know, a million here, a few hundred thousand there. That's a lot of money for a patient advocacy group or a pain management organization. And what these organizations did is they generated their own guidelines, seeking to relax constraints on opioid prescribing. When the CDC tried to create regulations to tighten up on opioid prescribing, these organizations that received industry money lobbied against the tightening of those regulations. And we also saw academic institutions, for example. There's a piece in Stat News just this week about Tufts and the money it took from pharmaceutical companies that were selling opioids. They gave platforms to members of the leadership, CEO and the like, as adjunct professors to come and talk about the drug and to downplay the risks of abuse and addiction. So what these partnerships, what these relationships did is they took organizations and entities that were grappling with a public health problem, pain management, but they got them onto to sing from their songbook. And their songbook was, opioids shouldn't just be used for terminal cancer pain. It should be used for acute and other forms of chronic pain. And the risks of abuse, while they're not as great as anticipated, and the risks of addiction are not as great, that's the story they told, that's the song they sang. And now we have an epidemic which takes 130 American lives a day and costs, according to the White House's Council of Economic Advisors, more than $500 billion a year in terms of social and economic costs alone.
So when these sorts of issues are raised to government officials, given that government is supposed to protect public health, you often, you know, hear the response that, well, the system will work, there will be some sort of accountability, the corporation may be fined, and then they go about doing their business. But these fines, these penalties that corporations are slapped with, are they just superficial? I mean, aren't they just included in the cost of doing business for these corporations? And once more, greenlit to continue until they're basically stopped. We have that the sort of this idea of do no harm is completely turned over on its head. The corporations are allowed to harm us till they have to pay a minimal fine that they can just write off as a cost of doing business and then continue and keep pushing the envelope because government just doesn't hold them accountable enough.
So it's certainly the case that the penalties as a percentage of the profits and the revenues are tiny. Again, in Senator McCaskill's report, she looked at the percentage of profits that constituted the fines that went to the opioid distributors who were distributing huge amounts of opioids to pill mills and little villages all across places like West Virginia. And again, you know, 0.0-something% if you think about the fine in terms of the profits and revenues. So yes, they are small. And then what happens is the corporations that created or exacerbated the public health problem are rewarded by being invited round the table again to try and solve the problems they created. So in 2017, when the NIH launched a partnership to address the opioid epidemic, it invited Purdue Pharma and a number of other pharmaceutical companies around the table. And Purdue, as you know, was pleaded guilty in 2007 to downplaying the risks of abuse and addiction. And then according to recent court filings in Massachusetts, continued that aggressive marketing strategy for another decade. Physicians, when they met with drug reps from Purdue in Massachusetts, according to these court filings, were 10 times more likely to subsequently have prescribed Purdue's drugs to patients who later died of an overdose than physicians who prescribed opioids without meeting the drug reps. That's hugely problematic. And the NIH's position now appears to be, okay, we won't partner with companies that are on the receiving end of litigation like Purdue is now, but we still want to enter into relationships, they appear to be saying. We won't take money, but we will take, you know, other things like drugs, gifts in kind, is what it's often called. And what I'm arguing is that still allows for influence. And more importantly, if you partner with drug companies to solve the opioid crisis, you're just going to get more drugs. If we really want to tackle the opioid epidemic, we have to look at all possible solutions to pain management, not just pharmaceuticals, and all possible solutions to the opioid epidemic as a social problem too.
It seems as though our government officials feel that corporations have some sort of inherent God-given right to profits at the expense of our health. And unfortunately, we have this contagion that has infected the government, infected at least the Republican Party and even some parts of the Democratic Party. Because if you do bring up that corporations should inherently not be trusted, that there should be this inherent tension between government and corporations, you're just labeled a socialist, right? That if you, that means you're relying on the government to do everything, and government is bad, corporations are good.
So that is the opposite of the Manichaean view that I was avoiding expressing at the beginning. And it's a ridiculous Manichaean view too. Neither is good nor ill. Corporations have been generated to make profits. Sure, let them engage in that activity. But the role of government is to protect the public good, including public health. And that inevitably involves regulating the corporate sector. Look, when the Boeing incident happened that you mentioned at the beginning, the CEO called up the president and said, "We have every confidence in our airplane," which, by the way, was, in my view, not a wise thing to do. But one should expect the CEO of a corporation like that to try and make the case, whatever case he or she can. But it's the job of government to say, it doesn't matter what confidence you have in the plane, Mr. CEO. The question is, what confidence do we as regulatory agencies and the public have? And it is our job as regulatory agencies to make sure the public's confidence, when it has it, is warranted.
So essentially, we have corporations being brought to the table and their representatives being brought to the table. We hear that kind of ideology of, or that kind of terminology often, when the public's health and safety is at stake, and they're brought in as partners rather than being seen as outside separate entities whose allegiance is first and foremost by design to their profits. I don't know if you've explored this in your book, but it seems as though one of the big reasons why government officials and agency heads and presidents and lawmakers tend to want to trust corporations is because that trust has sort of been bought and paid for through campaign contributions, right? They are reliant not just on corporations to make the funding available for underfunded projects, but also for their own re-election campaigns.
So absolutely. And what I say in the book, of course, is that the partnership paradigm is one part of a larger systemic problem. And that is, of course, that corporations seek to exercise influence in a variety of ways. One, as you say, is campaign contributions. Another is lobbying. Another is the revolving door. There are some people whose CVs look like this, the FDA, Monsanto, the FDA, Monsanto. And you see that across a whole host of industries.
Our acting defense secretary and Boeing.
Indeed. So what I argue is, look, corporations have these complex strategies of influence. Government agencies need complex strategies, comprehensive strategies to insulate themselves from influence. And that means more than just conflicts of interest policies, which are obviously important. It means a whole suite of measures designed to address this systemic problem.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
My guest has been Jonathan H. Marks, Director of the Bioethics Program at Penn State University, an affiliate faculty in Law and International Affairs. He's also an academic member of Matrix Chambers, London and Geneva, which is a leading group of human rights lawyers. His TED Talk, which we'll also link to, is called In Praise of Conflict and has over 1 million views. It was the basis for the book that we've been discussing, The Perils of Partnership, Industry Influence, Institutional Integrity, and Public Health. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. You can also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Climate change denialists like to question scientific research, perhaps assuming that the general public won't connect the dots between increased carbon dioxide levels and a warming planet. But on the science of air pollution, there is no argument that can explain away what people see before their own eyes and what they experience with their own health. Air pollution is a global threat to human and planetary health. And it's also a problem that can be stopped with strong legislation. Unfortunately, in the current rush to deregulate industries, we could be turning back the clock on the progress we've made. My guest is Dr. Gary Fuller. He is an air pollution scientist at King's College London. He also writes the Pollution Watch series for The Guardian, and he joins me to discuss his new book. It's called The Invisible Killer, The Rising Global Threat of Air Pollution and How We Can Fight Back. Welcome to the program, Dr. Fuller.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. So I was fascinated by reading some of the history of how we viewed pollution in the olden days, if you will. You're in London, and London is a city with a history of having really, really bad industrial pollution, which at one time was actually considered a good thing, a preservative, a protector against disease. Can you briefly give us that history lesson?
Yeah, that's right. London's been wrestling with its air pollution problems for centuries. There's writings from the 1600s where people have really found it difficult living in the city. London's air pollution problems are not just to do with industry. They were to do with just the sheer number of homes that were in the city burning coal for the most part. But oddly, at those times, people actually believed the air pollution was good for them. If you think back before the days of refrigeration, for instance, if you wanted to preserve meat or fish or something like that, then you would smoke it. And people actually wrote saying, thank goodness for the smoke in the air to protect us from things like the sulfur pollution.
How did that change then? How did we come to realize that that particulate matter in the air we breathe has a very serious health impact? And I imagine that that is what has then spurred some of the earliest regulations around air pollution.
Well, a lot of the early regulations were based around nuisance and were based around environmental impacts. You know, having a smelly factory next to you was deemed not to be a very good thing. And it's really surprising that it took us so long to realize the harm that air pollution was doing. It's not really to the 1952 smog in London that really we realized and took action for the first time. I mean, that was a horrible event. The city was shrouded in smog and fog for 5 or 6 days, and around 12,000 people died as a consequence. It's the worst peacetime disaster to strike the UK, and that really brought about a massive change.
So what are some of the laws that you cite in your book that shows that air pollution can be tackled? And of course, there have been laws for many, many years. We see many different cities around the world now struggling with smog. Thinking of, you know, Mumbai, India, or Beijing, China, and of course, Los Angeles, where our program is based, that has had historically a terrible smog problem that it tried to deal with legislation, right?
That's right. I mean, you could ask at any time, there's kind of the world's cliched smoggy or polluted city. And for a long time, it was London until we introduced the Clean Air Act that cleaned up the pollution that was coming from people's homes for the most part. Then I think the title probably shifted to Los Angeles, I'm afraid. And you wrestled with some really horrible air pollution that was much more modern than what we had in London. Your air pollution problems were caused through petroleum and through cars for the most part. So it's the transport in the city. You've done a fantastic job there. And the work that's been done in California is absolutely world leading. And now I think the title for the world's most polluted cities moved on again. It was Beijing, certainly, but now places like Delhi are really vying for truly the world's most polluted places.
What are the main sources of air pollution that need to be tackled? I mean, there are many, obviously. As you mentioned, vehicular emissions in places like Los Angeles, but then there's also factory pollution, right?
That's right. I mean, each place in the world has its own air pollution mixture, but often the sources are similar. So there's transport, there's the way in which we heat our homes and we run our industry as well. And then one of the things that we often overlook is the air pollution that comes from outside the city. So for instance, Delhi last year has had tremendous pollution problems. And those aren't coming just from within the city. They're coming from agricultural burning in the area around it. London today, or just earlier on this week, was affected a lot by agricultural pollution. So it's not just the things that you might think of as the obvious ones.
What is agricultural pollution? I mean, I sort of, when I think of industrial pollution, I'm thinking of coal burning plants, but we don't really think of agricultural pollution as a main source. What is that exactly?
No, we don't, which is why we haven't really tackled it sufficiently. I mean, I suppose the Delhi situation, what they have there is to improve the way in which the efficiency of their farming, if you like. A lot of it's become more mechanized, and with rice farming, for instance, the mechanical harvesting doesn't rip out all of the rice plants in the same way that it would be done by hand. Therefore, the farmers burn a lot of the stubble that's left. So I suppose that's quite an obvious pollutant. Less obvious is what comes from fertilizer, and what comes from animals and manure that's spread on land. So here in the UK, it's springtime, we've got flowers growing in the garden. Farmers are planting crops and they're putting their animals out for the first time because they keep them indoors for the most part in winter. And at the same time they do this, they're spreading the manure that was stored over winter and putting fertilizer onto the fields. And it's the ammonia from that that really damages our air pollution.
Is there a difference between animal agriculture and non-animal sort of, you know, produce that's grown? Because you often hear a sort of simplistic argument that if we want to take on things like climate change, we just need fewer people eating meat.
Yeah, we should all grow vegetarian for climate change. This is a slightly different issue, but also from the farmers. So it's not just whether you're farming animals or whether you're growing crops. It's really about the use of fertilizer and where the animal manure actually goes. So with better management, it's something that can be sorted out. From the farmer's perspective, though, if they go and put fertilizer on the field and the ammonia is then lost to the air, they're actually wasting money. So ways in which they can do it better are actually in their best interests as well.
Let's talk about one obvious aspect of the story, which is the impact to human health. I mean, I start picturing children struggling with asthma when we talk about air pollution, but it's a broader spectrum of health impacts than that, right?
Hugely. I mean, the best way to think about it is that air pollution is shortening our lives. If you live in London, then air pollution will shorten your life probably by around about 16 to 18 months. For most of the rest of the UK, it's similar. Our global figures are something of that order as well, perhaps 8-9 months or a year, or if you live in some of the most polluted places, several years. Now, people that die early through air pollution, if we found them in the streets, for instance, covered in green spots, then it would be really obvious that air pollution was the harmful agent. But when people die early through air pollution, they die through the diseases that they would die of normally anyway. So heart disease, respiratory disease, strokes, for instance. So there's no specific disease endpoints that you can point the finger and say, aha, that person died because of air pollution. It's just shortening their lives. So in that way, it's almost an invisible killer.
And hence the title of your book. So because does that then make it harder to make the case for strong legislation from all of these various air pollution sources, because it's not as clear how we connect the dots between air pollution and how it impacts human health? Does that stand in the way of progress?
Yes, it does. It's very difficult often to persuade the people that cause air pollution that they're doing harm and that they should spend money to remedy it. But if we don't do that, if you think about an industry, we used to think of an industry that, say, a town with factories with smoking chimneys as a sign of wealth. But in actual fact, it's a sign of subsidy, really. So the society and town and people around them are subsidizing that industry because the industry is not bearing the full cost of its impact. The difficulty is, though, when you yourself are the polluter, it's easy to point at a factory or something like that and say they should do something about it. But when I say to you, you know, you might think about your driving habits, for instance, that's a harder argument to get across.
Let's talk about coal burning plants, which you alluded to earlier in terms of how London tackled its problems. Through the Clean Air Act, we have a, strangely enough, in 2018 and 2019, a revival, at least rhetorically, of coal burning as a source of energy in the United States for political reasons. Our president wants to ingratiate himself with coal miners and their representatives. Even though coal is a dying industry, how deeply impactful is it on our health, and how can legislation actually tackle it? I mean, can the coal, is there such a thing as clean coal, or do we sort of need to phase it out entirely if we actually care about human health?
I think it's a very good question. I mean, my wife's family come from a coal mining community, or former coal mining community, and the way in which those mines have now closed and the way in which it changes the industrial town that she comes from is a very real problem. But then on the other hand, the damage that's caused through burning coal is very, very real as well. So we've got examples of London in the 1950s. The solution then was for the most part to put in so-called smokeless coal, and to move the industry out of the city. But we didn't really tackle the pollution. So that led to the acid rain problems that we experienced over Scandinavia. And you had similar issues in the US with your coal burning pollution going to Canada as well. It's a really dirty fuel, and it's very hard to burn it cleanly. It is possible, and we've shown this in Europe and in the US to some degree, but so much coal is being burnt around the world with very little emission controls. If you look at the problems that have been experienced in China, they're largely because of burning coal without any emission controls.
How important are scientific research and studies on this issue of tackling air pollution? Is there enough information? Is there enough research out there? Or are we at the point where we know enough and we have to stop trying to commission more studies and simply pour that effort into actually tackling the sources of pollution?
Yeah, I was called. I had to give evidence before the London Assembly a few years ago, and they asked me exactly the same question. They framed it slightly differently. When will we reach a point where we can be sure that there's enough evidence so that we need to do something about air pollution? And we passed that point years ago. The evidence that air pollution is harming our health and harms our environment as well, it is just completely overwhelming. So there's no reason not to act. We know also that in places where air pollution has been improved, and there's lots of examples of this around the world, we see benefits in health. There's lots of examples in the US as well. I mean, the Clean Air Program that you had that started in 1990 and is just running on to an end at the end of this decade. If you look at the amount of money spent by industry and the health burden that was saved, if you like, the US has got a sort of like 30 times greater return for its investment than it actually spent. So wow. Undoubtedly, it's a good thing to do.
Tell us about the six cities study that you describe in your book and why that was such an important study.
The Six Cities Study had its 25th birthday just at the end of last year. If you think London in the 1950s told us that short-term smogs were really harmful to health, the Six Cities Study taught us something entirely different. They didn't just look at short-term smogs. They studied the thousands of people, several thousand people, across six cities in the US for 14 or 15 years. And each year they wrote to them, basically sent them a postcard saying, are you dead yet? And if they didn't get a reply, then they sent out an investigator to find out whether the person was still alive or what they'd died of. And they found people living in more polluted cities were dying sooner. And that told us that it's not just the air pollution we breathe during smogs, it's the air pollution that we breathe every day that's causing us most harm and shortening our lives. But that situation has taken a new twist in the last couple of years. And what we're learning now is that the air pollution that you might experience as a child, for instance, or even pre-birth, might cause a permanent sort of impairment for the rest of your life. So we've been studying kids in East London, and we've studied several thousand, and we've measured the size of their lungs. And we found that kids that are in the most polluted places are growing smaller lungs. Now, this might not be a problem for them now, because it's only a small difference, unless they want to go up to be Mo Farah or some sort of, you know, athlete or something like that. But if you think about the older people in your family and about the end of their lives, you know, the last few years of people's lives are often full of a struggle for breath and diseases and coughing and things like that. So if people enter that time with smaller lungs, then it's going to be very difficult and their life chances are not as good.
One of the things that you alluded to earlier in our conversation and that you write about in your book is indoor air pollution. And that's also something that we tend to separate from global air pollution risks that come from things like factories. How important is it for us to take on this issue of indoor air pollution? How deadly is it?
We don't know so much about indoor air pollution. It's quite a fragmented area of science. But we do know that the things that we do in our home do cause pollution, and this is changing quite a bit as well. And I assume it's the same in the US, but there's a big push towards making our houses more energy efficient. I live in quite an efficient, energy efficient house. That means it doesn't have many drafts. So the products that we use in our home, from deodorants to our inkjet in our printer to our cooking and so forth, stay in our home longer, and this can cause us harm. We're also seeing an interesting change whereby we've controlled certain pollutants, certain sort of solvents and organics from industry and from traffic and so forth. So for some things that cause summertime smogs, the single biggest source now is the products that we use in our homes rather than our traffic and factories.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Gary Fuller, in discussing your new book. Thanks so much. Good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
My guest has been Dr. Gary Fuller, an air pollution scientist at King's College in London. He writes the Pollution Watch series for The Guardian. We've been discussing his new book. It's called The Invisible Killer, The Rising Global Threat of Air Pollution and How We Can Fight Back. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali. KPFK Pacifica Radio. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Anybody who's struggling with unemployment in the U.S. today knows that acquiring a job means marketing oneself to companies that are hiring, being open to flexible hours, engaging in creative and innovative thinking, and developing a personal brand. All of these are considered essential to finding a way to make ends meet. Well, where did this glossy language originate? And what do the words obscure about the reality of today's capitalist job market? Exploring the new language of capitalism in a new book is John Patrick Leary, Associate Professor of English at Wayne State University in Detroit. His earlier book was called A Cultural History of Underdevelopment, Latin America in the U.S. Imagination. His new book is called Keywords, The New Language of Capitalism. Welcome to the program, John.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So we, I think, take for granted a lot of this language. It's something that we're steeped in these days. Companies like to use this a lot. Companies like Amazon, when they're looking for workers. Forbes.com uses a lot of this in its business coverage. But when did you when did this sort of language and this lexicon start to creep in to our day-to-day use, as far as you know?
Well, I mean, I can tell you when a very specific moment when it crept into my consciousness was in Chicago, and I was walking through some sort of food court in a shopping center downtown, and I noticed it kind of came to a head where I just noticed the word innovation everywhere around me, and the constant exhortation to innovate or be innovative, and the selling of everything from, you know, hamburgers to computers as acquiring the experience of innovation. And it annoyed me so much as just a kind of failure to communicate anything, and it seemed so deceitful that it first irritated me, then it started to interest me in terms to find out more where this kind of peculiarly vague vocabulary comes from. So some of it is quite old. Some of these kinds of words are themselves quite old. Some of their usages in economic concepts are old, but a lot of them are quite new, and they're a creature in part of the 1960s and 70s, and then others are of much more recent vintage.
It seems as though some of this is language that corporations had used to describe about themselves that has migrated into people using it about their individual selves, such as branding. We used to talk about corporations branding themselves. Now people brand themselves. And does some of this language originate from the kind of disturbing blurring of lines between corporations and people?
Yeah, I mean, that's the function of a lot of the words that I talk about. There's a whole category of words in the book that I call capitalist body talk. And those are words like flexibility, which you mentioned in your intro, branding, which is a word that we often forget originates in the searing of animal and also human flesh.
Oh my goodness, you're right.
Right, it's easy to forget what a brand originally connoted. And words like nimble and agile and so forth. You know, the nimble corporation, which is a word you hear a lot in the business press and in the kind of mainstream press as well, is a corporation that has laid off a significant number of workers and is able to therefore minimize its labor costs. A nimble, of course, is a word that we used to use more often to describe an athlete or something, or a child jumping over a candlestick in the nursery rhyme, which is most people's other association with that word. But when we use it to talk about a corporation, you know, a vast bureaucracy, a profit-making enterprise, what we're doing is we're kind of conflating the individual with the corporation. We're imagining the corporation as a single person, as a single body, rather than as a collection of individual, overstressed, overworked, underpaid bodies.
So nimble is also something that's now demanded from workers, to be nimble or flexibility, which is basically be available when we need you, right? I mean, corporations use this word flexibility to promote the other phrase that's been popularized, which is the sharing economy or the gig economy, where this idea that corporations are going to be able to tap into workers as they need them, it also somehow works in the favor of workers. So they have flexible working hours. Amazon hires a bunch of seasonal employees and then lays them all off when the holiday season is over. What does that obscure about the treatment of workers?
Well, I mean, it obscures exploitation, to put it simply. A flexible, you never hear I talk about a flexible corporation. You hear a lot of talk about nimble corporations. There's something athletic, there's something somewhat exciting about nimbleness, but flexibility is an attribute that's only extended to workers. And it sounds on first glance like it's perhaps a positive characteristic to be flexible, but to be flexible means it means you can be bent in many different directions. It means
contortionist.
Yes, it's to be a contortionist, but for an audience that doesn't need you and doesn't appreciate you and doesn't pay you very well. So flexibility is really an attempt to, if I may say, rebrand the exploitative working conditions that are more and more common in the kinds of fields you mentioned.
I want to sort of go through some of the words in alphabetical order, because that's the way in which you put them in your book, Keywords, The New Language of Capitalism. One of my favorites is artisanal. Artisanal is one of these words that is tacked onto the front of many products, particularly in the food industry. Artisanal is basically, I don't know what exactly it's supposed to mean, but how do you define it? It seems as though it's used as an excuse to just charge people more money for the same thing.
That's definitely one way of looking at it. A lot of the words that I talk about in the book are ways of evading meaning. And so what I do in each of the entries is to kind of dig deeply into their etymological histories, into their histories as words, and into some of their usages. But ultimately what they do is they evade clarity. And artisanal is a good example. I mean, it's also an example of a word that has a long, somewhat surprising, perhaps, history in economics. So, I mean, the artisanal the original artisan, the kinds of people that the current Vogue looks back nostalgically on, you know, were workers who worked independently in shops who were then assimilated into factory production, you know, in the 19th century. So critics of the industrial labor system would look back on the artisan as somebody who had been lost and sort of who had been forcibly turned into an industrial worker. And now there, with this kind of sense that's popular, at least among the middle classes of the, you know, of Western Europe and North America, this sense of malaise about processed food and factory-made clothing and so forth, there's this nostalgia for this ideal of an artisan who can somehow both can thrive in contemporary consumer culture and provide us with the sense of meaning or sense of authenticity that certain bourgeois consumers seek out.
Another favorite is choice. We hear this word choice in so many different contexts. You can hear it in the promotion of charter schools and education, school choice. There's, you know, the members of Congress often use it when they want to talk about healthcare. And of course, the corporate sector loves the word choice. How do you explain this keyword in how it's used in, especially in corporate America?
Well, it intersects a little bit with the idea of the nimble corporation and the flexible worker, because there's this sense in all of those words of a celebration of individual agency, that we can all find our own way and live our own autonomous lives within this kinds of within this kind of economic and political system that we have. And the predominance of choice in both politics and in economic language and in, you know, advertising and so forth is intended to disguise the kind of discipline and the kind of unfreedom that we all experience in the market as a kind of autonomy. So when you talk about choices in education, you know, the United States education system is set up in such a way that people who live in particular zip codes get a particular kind of education, you know. So our freedom to pursue an education is severely limited by the inequality of the United States. But when you frame the privatization of public education as choice, you're making it seem as if you're producing some new sense of autonomy and agency, when really what you're doing is even more severely undercutting the ideal of an egalitarian public education. So you're framing things in these very individualistic terms to sort of disguise the degradation of social goods.
And I think so critical what you just said, that these words, these keywords are reframing many of the concepts that we take for granted. And in reframing them, they are subtly and often invisibly changing the conversation around how we view the collective good, how we view individualism versus collectivism, and how we view the corporate world as well. I would love for you to talk about the word disruption. That's a really interesting word. Often someone who's disruptive is seen in a negative light, but these days, if you want big investment in your latest tech company, you describe yourself as a disruptor. Donald Trump was described as a disruptor. Uber is disrupting the taxi industry, and that's seen as a positive thing. How did that word turn into a positive thing?
Well, this is one of the rare words that I talk about that really has a single author or origin story. And the author of Disruption is this business writer named Clayton Christensen, who wrote a book called The Innovator's Dilemma, probably about 20 years ago now or so, that really brought the word disruption into broader use. And so it's a word that, yes, as you said, in the political realm, it still is a kind of pejorative, at least depending on who's talking. But when, for example, Disrupt J20, the protesters interrupted the inauguration of President Trump, they were, you know, prosecuted for that disruption. When Uber or Apple or whomever is credited with disrupting an industry, you know, we don't talk about, of course, the human cost of what Uber does to taxi drivers But disruption is the popularity of disruption is, first of all, a sign of just the uncritical exuberance with which, frankly, the stupidity of a lot of business journalism gets embraced. I mean, disruption is a word that kind of a lot of people roll their eyes at now. Even some business school people find it to be a cliche. But the popularity of it, I think, is a sign of that, but it's also a sign of a mainstream business and other kinds of press that celebrate the will of corporations and of capitalists to sort of set the agenda. You know, the idea that a company disrupts an existing industry for its own advantage is not obviously a good thing. I mean, it's sort of remarkable that it's been embraced as this kind of virtuous process.
Leadership is another favorite word for employers looking for people with leadership skills, only to then peg them into places where they can't exactly exercise leadership or they would be fired for insubordination. How does the word leadership obscure the very strongly hierarchical world of of capitalism and of corporate America?
Well, yeah, it's an interesting way you ask that question because it sort of obscures the hierarchical nature of a lot of institutions by actually celebrating it. I mean, because, you know, leaders are ostensibly the pillars the pinnacles of a hierarchy. But one of the ways that leadership has always been celebrated in American culture, and it's been a big word in self-help for a century, is that it is simultaneously a kind of very elitist concept, perhaps for obvious reasons, because it celebrates leaders, but it is also a peculiarly populist or democratic, it pretends to be a democratic concept as well. You know, everybody can be a leader. Even the kid in the mailroom can be a leader of the mailroom. And everybody can train to be a leader. And universities now emphasize leadership as a kind of moral personality trait that they want student applicants to have. So it purports to be something that we can all access, but of course we don't all get paid as leaders, even if we supposedly possess whatever mystical personality traits are the stuff that make leaders.
So our salary brackets aren't leadership quality, but we have to be.
No.
So it's interesting, and there's so much, you know, we could go on and on. The words that you describe in your book that we just see everywhere: resilience, stakeholders, sustainable, thought leaders. That's one of my favorites. entrepreneurship, to be a curator. All of these are keywords that we tend to take for granted, but it feels to me as though they are keywords that go hand in hand with a uniquely American sensibility of individualism over collectivism that we've been told over and over again, this myth of the self-made man or woman in the United States that wants to obscure the role of organized labor, that wants to obscure the role of government in doing the social good that we need. Is this sort of a uniquely American phenomenon that is now sort of spreading to other parts of the world?
Well, it certainly does have deep roots in the United States. You know, the idea that a lot of my keywords that I talk about, you mentioned a few: resilience, thought leadership. These are all words that connote a sense of virtue, a sense of like moral goodness, and also success. And the idea that those two things follow naturally from each other is a kind of deeply American idea. I mean, it goes back to Benjamin Franklin, if not earlier. So there's a sense that in these words, what I'm kind of doing is chronicling the latest version of a very old story in the United States. I don't know if the United States can claim sole credit for having exported these kinds of pernicious concepts to other parts of the world. I would leave it to critics from other places and in working in other languages to say that. But there is something, certainly deeply rooted in the United States that celebrates success as a moral consequence, you know, something that happens to good people.
So, well, John, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck to you.
Well, thank you very much.
My guest has been John Patrick Leary, Associate Professor of English at Wayne State University in Detroit. And we've been talking about his new book, Keywords, The New Language of Capitalism. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video channel on Vimeo.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kolhatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band, Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RUWithSonali. That's the letters, RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RUWithSonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Tune in to KBOO every Friday at 6 p.m. from September 15th to October 15th for KBOO's Hispanic Heritage Month series. Join KBOO in celebrating and paying tribute to the contributions and enriching influences of Hispanic and Latinx Americans and their ancestors. You'll hear from volunteer producers from Buscando America, Boogie Pachanguero, Noticias en Español, and more. Again, that's KBOO's Hispanic Heritage Month series, every Friday at 6 p.m. from September 15th to October 15th. Here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.